When we met, you had nothing but contempt for the crumbling leadership of the Klingon Empire.
The Kuvma sought to strengthen and unify the great houses. If he has succeeded in only this, it is cause for celebration.
Your great houses are carving up Federation assets among their factions. A captured starbase bears the insignia of House Dagor, not of the Klingon Empire. Is that the kind of unity your messiah proclaimed? They think nothing of the collateral damage caused by their brutal attacks. They target civilians, hospitals, food convoys. They slaughter innocents and inspire terror across the quadrant.
This is war, not a child's game with rules. We fight to preserve Klingon identity.
No one is looking to destroy your culture. Our laws are founded in equality. Freedom.
The Kuvma taught us that the Federation cannot help itself. It seeks universal homogenization and assimilation.
The Kuvma was an ignorant fool. And your people are moving closer and closer to my home planet. What are you looking for? More territory? Conditional surrender? I mean, your people won't even make demands. Why? How does this war end?
It doesn't. Klingons have tasted your blood. Conquer us, or we will never relent.
Welcome to Simply Syndicated's Discovery After Show, your place for a detailed analysis of each episode of Star Trek Discovery. Now here are your hosts, Sean Ray and Rick Tatro.
Hello everyone and welcome to Simply Syndicated's Discovery After Show. My name is Sean Ray and tonight we're going to be talking about the 14th and penultimate episode of the first season of Star Trek Discovery, which was titled The War Without, The War Within. It was written by Lisa Randolph and directed by David Solomon, and I'm thankful for people with easy-to-pronounce names. And joining me tonight, first and foremost, is the Admiral of Simply Syndicated. Rick, how are you, sir?
I am here. I don't have anything clever to open with tonight, folks. It's been a rough Monday.
And also with us, once again, is novelist and journalist and sci-fi connoisseur, Christopher DeFilippis. How are you,
I'm a connoisseur now, huh? Yeah. You know, I've been on your show a few times, so it's really upped my rating. So I'm doing much better than I thought. I'm a connoisseur.
Okay, John's not here. He may join us before the show is over. He may not. So we don't really have a plot summary, but I'm assuming that anyone that's listening to the episode has probably seen the episode and they know what happened. So what I'm going to do is what we normally do, we'll just kind of go around the virtual circle and give this episode a thumbs up or thumbs down or a general overall rating. So Rick, what did you think of last night's episode?
Well, first, I think we're a triangle tonight, not a circle, but
yeah, true.
it was okay. It was mostly a Basil exposition episode, so, I mean, there were no holy crap moments, but it was a good, solid bridge between where we were and where we're going episode, although, I mean, there were some great moments, but this was one of the few episodes this season that, at the end of it, I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was just kind of like, all right, we're there.
Yeah, and I was kind of, I mean, I'm not going to say I was disappointed with the episode because I really liked the episode, but it was a lot slower than what I'm used to getting in a next to the last episode of the season. Usually the next to the last episode is the episode where like stuff really happens, you know. On The Walking Dead, that's when people die, you know, stuff like that. But Chris, what did you think?
I'm going to go with you guys on this one. I guess like a thumb sideways. It was, it's funny because there are so many episodes from the season that I had so much to say about, and I'm like, oh, I wish I was on Sean's show. Oh, I wish I was talking to Rick about this. And here I am. And it's just like, oh, this is the one. All right. Well, like you said, a heap and helping of exposition, a lot of setup, not very action-packed, but I don't necessarily need that for good Star Trek. I liked a lot of the character moments. I thought there were like some really terrific character beats. And I just wish I had cared about it a little more than I did. So that's not to say that it was bad. It was just it didn't really ring that many bells for me. It just really seemed like, guess what? You're going to really have to wait till next week, guys, because we're setting this up like crazy. And, I hope they pay off and do something really big with it.
Well, that was my thought when the episode ended. I turned to my wife and I said, if they're going to do what they said they were going to do and wrap up the Klingon War this season, they're going to be cramming a whole lot of stuff into next week.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if next week was going to be a regular length episode or if it was going to be a little longer, you know, because traditionally the last episode of a Star Trek season is part one of a two-parter. So where I'm kind of hoping that they wrap things up and don't leave us with a giant cliffhanger, just kind of give us a little cliffhanger or something like that.
Can I quote John, since he's not here, a close hanger?
Yeah, close hanger. There you go. But yeah.
Well, I don't think they're going to leave, you know, I'm sure they will leave some things to tease us, to make us, you know, to make people come back. But I don't think they're going to do like a best of both worlds type of cliffhanger to us, not in the first season.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see that happening either. Mainly because everything about this season has been leading up to some kind of resolution of the Klingon War arc. And the fact that they're bringing it home in these last two episodes, I can't imagine. It's not like we've had three seasons and holy shit, Picard has been assimilated and Riker's firing on that Borg cube. We had a lot more invested in those characters then. And I say we academically. I didn't watch Next Gen, so I didn't really see that until reruns after I saw Generations. But I can't see them successfully doing that in this series. I can see them laying some seeds, planting some seeds, maybe even pivoting into a completely new direction after the Klingon War arc is resolved in some fashion. But I don't think that we're going to have a cliffhanger on whether or not the war will end, kind of like we used to get on Deep Space Nine a lot too. You know, the Jem'Hadar are massing and they're pouring out of the wormhole and holy shit, here we are. What are we going to do? Well, we'll see you in 6 months, people.
Yeah. I kind of liken it to what they do on The Flash, or what they've done on The Flash for the past few seasons, is they have a season-long arc that they wrap up in that finale, and then in the last 5 minutes they introduce something else to leave the cliffhanger. So I'm kind of hoping that they do something like that. That's why I said a soft cliffhanger, you know, where you wrap everything up. And then you do a cliffhanger that's about something completely different.
Well, but here's I'm with you on that one, Sean. But I think sometimes The Flash does it almost like an add-on. As I said before, I hope that this one, the conclusion of the Klingon War arc, naturally pivots into some new storyline that we weren't expecting, and I'll be happy with something like that.
We're going to get into all the stuff that happened in the episode, but I do want to say, and this is, we're getting into spoilers. If that's as far as they go with the Ash Vok storyline, I'm kind of disappointed. It just feels like it just dropped. Like the whole thing was building up and now it's just over. And it just, you know what I mean?
Or am I the only one that feels that way? I felt that way. I thought that for all the buildup that they did for Vok to be, quote, dead this soon after the revelation was very abrupt. Now, you know that Laurel is canny and she's crafty.
Yeah.
I wonder if she just sort of put Vok back to sleep somehow. I don't know if that would be good writing or bad writing, but I'm like you. I feel like we can't really be done with this already, can we?
It feels like we are. If we are, I'm kind of disappointed in it because I was expecting Vok to kind of take over, maybe not permanently, but really take over for a little while and really cause some major problems. And he didn't. He just kind of went to sick bay.
If I can just liken it to something that Ron Moore said about Seven of Nine in Voyager, some interviews I read. When she came on, they basically made her look human within two or three episodes. Mm-hmm. And he said, she's a Borg. Why not keep her looking like a Borg? It's much more compelling because the crew will have to learn to deal with her as she is. But instead, they just wanted to make her Jeri Ryan. In this, Tyler was Vok. Vok was Tyler. Why shy away from that? Why not have him be both Vok and Tyler somehow? Mm-hmm. Maybe warring halves, maybe trying to come to terms within himself. But to just drop the Vok personality altogether, as you said, Sean, just seemed abrupt, and it seemed like a missed opportunity if that's in fact what they're doing, if they don't pull a switcheroo on us next week.
Right.
Yeah, because that I could understand. Well, sorry, I'm not being very clear tonight. I could see Laurel maneuvering her way to get into sickbay to work on him. But then when she killed the Vok personality, that made no sense to me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Unless she, you know, again, you know, how often has Laurel told the truth yet or done anything that was not multi-layered and worthy of a Bene Gesserit? So maybe she did just put Vok to sleep and pretend to be upset, because her death scream seemed kind of half-assed, but I couldn't tell if that was just because she couldn't open her mouth any wider in the makeup.
Yeah.
You know, I would love it. Well, part of me is glad they didn't do the whole, well, he's pretending to be Ash, but he's still really Vok, because that kind of storyline bugs me. It just makes me uncomfortable. But that's just my own peccadilloes. That's, you know, neither here nor there from a story perspective. So I was kind of relieved when they're like, oh, okay, he's back to Ash again, and now we have to deal with, he has to deal with, you know, everyone either hating him or not. And the scene in the mess hall, when I watched it a second time about an hour ago, when Tilly got up and went over to the table, I actually got a little choked up. It was like, that was one of the, Tilly is just amazing. Her character has been so wonderful and just keeps getting better. And the things she said to both Ash and Burnham in this episode were some of the best moments of the show.
I agree, but I found that to be a little bit weird, and let me tell you why. Vok slash Tyler killed somebody in cold blood. Maybe he didn't know he was doing it, but it was an act of violence against an innocent. Mm-hmm. And here he is. It's about 10 minutes later, and the entire crew is, "Hey, welcome back! Yeah, oh, to poor you, whatever." And that's great. That embraces sort of like the core philosophy of Star Trek. I like that. But you have Burnham. You know, I guess she mutineered, and they're laying the war at her feet. Yet she is ostracized. She's an eternal outcast. Why? Because of the mutiny factor? I mean, where was that turn the other cheek attitude at the beginning of the season? When Michael walked onto that bridge, she was nothing but a pariah. And even I forget the helmsman, the girl Detmer. With the tech, Detmer, looked at her with open hostility and hatred.
Yeah. Yeah, she did.
So I just found it really odd that Tyler's journey, if he is indeed, you know, only Tyler at this point, was so quick. That the turnaround was so quick, and the acceptance and the love of the crew was back right there.
Well, I kind of chalked it up to, you know, when Burnham came onto the Discovery, the war had been going on for 6 months. So, you know, the Discovery crew were not exactly the battle hardened, traumatized people they are now, especially after their jaunt through the Mirror Universe. So, you know, wartime tends to bring out the best and worst in people. And so I think everybody was perfectly fine with shunning Tyler until Tilly went, fuck this, and sat down with him. And then, you know, people sort of said, well, okay, if she can do it, you know, then maybe it's not so bad.
Yeah, and I thought it really fit her personality to do that. But then everybody in the entire mess hall starts gathering around the table. I was like, that's a little strange. It kind of reminded me of a scene from a high school movie or something. but yeah, I mean, that Tilly would do that, I believe it, you know, because it fits her. I just don't know if I would believe that everybody in the entire mess hall would start gathering on the table and laughing and cutting up and everything like that. But
yeah, but there was a powerful scene between Vok, Tyler and Stamets. And I don't think he's going to get that. I mean, Stamets is a dick to most people on his best day.
Yeah.
So I don't think that Tyler is going to get any kind of accolades from him or any cheek turning, so to speak. But
well,
it was funny.
He did make one line. Stamets did make one line there at the end where he said, maybe you are still human after all, which kind of tells me that Stamets knows that it wasn't him that did it. He's just not ready to forgive him, you know.
Or maybe he won't ever be, but I don't think I need to see that resolution. I don't especially think that's important to the story.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's dig into the episode a little bit. So we'll start from the beginning. Saru got his feelings hurt because Michael didn't tell him about her dinner. It seems like a really weird thing for him to get mad about. He should realize, oh, yeah, I probably don't want to know that they ate me or that they ate a...
Well, that's not what he was upset about. He was upset because she told him that she didn't see any Kelpians.
Any Kelpians at all, yeah. Well, yeah I did see one on the table. but anyway, Discovery is on auxiliary power because they got damaged in that jump. And Saru tells Michael that Ash is alive, and he says he'd like to see how he reacts when he sees Michael. And she says, is that an order? And he says, no. So she says, no, I don't want to see him. So the doctor... Go ahead.
The whole dynamic between Ash and Burnham is beautiful. You know, we'll get into their scene later on. But, you know, when she said, then, no, I'm not going to do it. It was one of the most real moments, I think, in Star Trek, because nothing would have been more Star Trek than for her to prance into sick bay and been like, OK, everything's all better now. Which that would have been way too much.
Yeah. Well, she hasn't been there to see all of the turmoil that he's in. The last time that she saw him, he tried to kill her. You know, so that's all that she can think about is, you know, that he just tried to murder her. But the doctor tells Saru that as far as she can tell, there are no signs of Vok. Vok is gone, but Ash is not human and he's not Klingon. He's something else.
Yeah, what does that mean? I'm still very unclear as to how they transferred. Is it Vok? Is it Tyler? Is it half and half? Is it from what Tyler said, they actually altered Vok physically.
Yes.
But then they talk about imprinting his personality onto Tyler. But it's almost like they don't know themselves. They keep on referring to it both ways.
Yeah, I don't really think they want to define it.
I was going to say, does anybody have a clear bead on this? Or is it just me that's not really understanding what exactly happened here?
They want to make it more than just we took his mind and put him in this body, because that's something you do in old Star Trek. That's something you do in old cartoons and Gilligan's Island and stuff like that. You know, they want it to be more than that. So they're putting explanations out there. Sometimes the explanations kind of contradict themselves, but
well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, so that's bad writing, right?
Well, I think I think it's more of if it's intentional, I think it's trying to point up the fact that there is a great deal of confusion about this. That's why they keep asking that's why, you know, when Saru was saying, we need to understand more about this, I was kind of like, well, didn't they already tell you exactly what they did? But apparently not.
Well, they got that explanation from Laurel, and you don't know how truthful she was being. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, now my Skype on my computer is making noise.
<What the hell? laughs>
You're saying you guys are saying hi to me. Jeez. Skype is being very weird, folks. More so than usual. I mean, I heard echoes of Arne Darvin in this episode.
Yeah,
I was thinking the same thing, but maybe because I was just watching Troubled Tribble, so and Trials and Tribulations, and there's a whole thing I want to get into later, but let's stick to the topic at hand.
I don't know. I think that maybe they kind of got themselves into a bit of a mess where they wanted to make the Klingons very, very alien, which they totally succeeded in, but then they needed one to be very, very human so that it could dovetail into the continuity that we know. And then, you know, going from Kor to Arne Darvin is not that big a leap. Going from Valk to Ash is a huge leap. And I'm not sure that they were, I don't think they're handling it as well as they wanted to. But
you know,
it's
a leap they didn't even have to make. Enterprise filled in that gap pretty well, I think. So, well, according to, and in this one, they did specifically reference Jonathan Archer in the NX-01.
Yeah, they did.
So, you know, Enterprise is still canon in this universe. What happens to the Klingons that look like humans because of the augment virus? My pet Targ wouldn't recognize me looking like this. Obviously, yeah. There are Klingons in this version of reality that look like humans.
Yeah.
Because
I don't think we've seen them yet.
I know this is a lot of like deep inside fan baseball, and maybe we're the only ones that care about it, but it's just,
oh no, we're not.
It's just so many contradictory things. And they keep saying, no, we'll address that and we'll get closer and we'll dovetail by season two. But it's just like, well, there's already things that you're not explaining or ignoring or retconning. So how are you going to dovetail if you're just so openly retconning? I don't mind if you retcon away. But don't say that you're going to be true to canon. I don't care specifically at this point in my fandom whether or not you're adhering to canon that strictly. As long as I'm entertained, I can always retcon it in my head. But at the same time, why bring it up specifically and make it completely different but yet reference everything that came before?
Well,
I'm that impossible to please Star Trek fan. I just realized. I'll shut my mouth.
Well, you see, the thing is, I used to be you, my son. I think I'm older than you are, maybe by a bit, but you know, if this was happening 20 years ago, I would be one of the people just screaming, this is bullshit. You can't possibly make this work. But I've also, you know, I was one of the guys in 1986 who was like, Star Trek without Kirk and Spock? What is this foolishness?
Yeah.
You know, and for two seasons, I sat on my high horse going, see, it's crap. But then I was also, by the end of season three, screaming at my TV, no, you can't leave us there. You know, I've seen Star Trek reinvented with every new series. Granted, this one is the most drastic, but not by that much, really, if you look at Enterprise. If you compare DS9 to Enterprise or Voyager to Enterprise, you know, a lot of the arguments that we got about Enterprise we're getting about this show, and it's because it's a prequel you know, people want the impossible. They want something that looks like what we got in 1966, but don't you dare make it look like it was in 1966. You're like, well, how the fuck are you supposed to win that argument?
Yeah.
And I can tell you, Rick, I used to be that guy, too, that just... But I mean, in the last few years, in the last 3 or 4 years, I just let it go because honestly, who gives a shit?
Yeah, exactly.
Really, I'm going to get bent out of shape over this, and I still enjoy it equally. I mean, I love the fact that they're doing something new because I think that's what killed Star Trek on TV to begin with. It just became moribund because they weren't willing to do anything different than have the captain on the bridge doing an episode of the week.
Yeah.
And it needed to be shaken up somehow. So I'm right there. And I don't mind the aesthetic changes in this. I don't mind if they are breaking canon. It really doesn't bother me as long as the story is good. It's just that sometimes it's hard to juxtapose what we know with what they're showing, yet they're giving lip service to what we know, but still showing something different.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And I'm intrigued as to if they're going to be able to pull off what they say they are going to.
And in the end, I think that's a standard they shouldn't have to hold themselves to. As long as this show stands by itself as its own thing, and, you know, coherent, consistently coherent internally.
Yeah.
Then I'm fine with it. As long as it sets up its own rules in its version of the Star Trek universe and sticks by them, I'm happy with that. But anyway.
Because I saw in this one, as I was watching it for the second time, something occurred to me, because one of the things that does, I've said this before, I'm the nerd that will argue warp theory all night. And
that's a whole new podcast.
Actually, I just did that one. I just guessed it on another show about ships. And I got into the bolts that hold the hull together. I did a deep dive on that one, and it was fun. But it occurred to me, because one of the things that has been giving me trouble is the appearance of the ships. The ships are much more JJ than what we're used to. And it just dawned on me, they've lost, what did they say, 2/3 of the fleet, something like that. So maybe what we're seeing is the setup for most of the ships with the rectangular nacelles and the kind of weird look that we're not exactly used to seeing are going to be destroyed in this war, and the new cylindrical nacelles and smoother hulls and stuff is what's going to be the replacement fleet.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Constitution class starships are out there because the Enterprise exists at this point.
True. But. And that may be the state of the art, is those the look we're used to. Maybe still, the.
I get that, but it's still hard. It's funny. It would be nice to know how many other Constitution class vessels were in service contemporary to Pike's first 5-year mission.
Yeah.
And then we'd get a sense of, when they say they destroyed 2/3 of the fleet, there have to be some Constitution class ships and, you know, involved in that.
Good point. I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah.
So, you guys, I can really go into the weeds too. I'm a fan's fan. But again, if you think about that stuff too much, then you'll never enjoy anything ever again. So
Exactly.
So Cornwall and Sarek beam on board the ship. And she takes control of the Discovery by phaser point. And Sarek mind melds with Saru to find out if they are real, since as far as they know, Discovery was destroyed 9 months before. So we did all this speculation last week that the Discovery has been in the Prime Universe and causing all this trouble. And turns out they got destroyed as soon as they got there.
Yeah, what does that say about Captain Killy? She must be a really shitty captain.
Because, I mean, that also tells me that if they had not jumped into the Mirror Universe, they probably would have been destroyed, because the ISS Discovery got the Klingon attack that the Discovery was about to get.
Good point.
So I guess traveling to the Mirror Universe saved them, But yeah, they said that the Discovery was destroyed 9 months ago, and she says that she saw the wreckage. She saw it happen, you know, so it definitely did happen. So yeah, the Mirror Discovery has not been in the Prime Universe causing problems and siding with the Klingons and all that kind of stuff.
I'm not surprised, because a lot of people were saying, oh, the Discovery is going to just be going apeshit, and The Mirror Discovery didn't have the spore drive.
Yeah.
So she was no more badass than the other ship. And especially if she came from a universe where the Klingons are kind of... There's nothing to fear from them.
Yeah.
Anymore. Mm. She may have just been like, Klingons, who cares? Boom.
Yeah. Right. Did you guys notice the look that Sarek gave Michael when he realized that he thought she was dead? She's been dead to him for the last 9 months, and then he's laying eyes on her, and it broke his Vulcanness, because I saw emotions come through.
I didn't pick up on that, and I saw the beginning of this episode 4 separate times before I was able to finally see the end, and I'll have to look again. Maybe I'll have to watch it a fifth time to catch that.
There was a moment where he was addressing the crew. He was addressing the bridge, or everybody on the bridge, but he was looking at Michael. you know, and you could tell in the look that he was giving her, hey, I thought you were dead.
Yeah, I mean, I know he was staring at her.
Yeah.
It didn't even occur to me that he thought that she was dead. That's mm-hmm. that's brilliant.
Okay, so the lady's name that plays Cornwall, what's her name again? I had it just a second ago.
It is Jane Brooke.
Yes. She did an awesome job in this episode. Every scene that she was in, I thought she was incredible.
I love her more and more with every performance.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing that got me, I watched the episode twice. I didn't catch it the first time, but she said that, okay, so a person from our universe would not survive very long in the other universe. And then she said, so my Gabriel is dead. You know, she
called, which means he's not.
Well, yeah, probably, but it caught me that she called him her Gabriel, you know. So, you know, I mean, we know that they slept together and that they had a history, but obviously she has some very, very deep feelings for him. And
well, she wouldn't have come all the way out to the Discovery if she didn't.
Yeah,
you know, true. She doesn't wear her heart on her sleeve, but it was pretty well established that he was very important to her.
Yeah. Now, can I point out a little bit of a glitch in maybe some of the logic of the episode? It might be skipping ahead a bit, but since we're talking about her finding the Discovery after thinking it was destroyed, I saw it destroyed 9 months ago. Later in the episode, they say there is no such thing as a mirror universe. We're going to quash that down because reasons. you know, we're putting it into a black bag and we're going to throw that black bag into a black hole and no one's ever heard of it. Understood? If the Discovery was destroyed 9 months ago, wouldn't that be a matter of record? So where did the Discovery come from all of a sudden? Now that it's back in the fleet.
Well, I think they're kind of relying on the in wartime reports can be inaccurate. I mean, they're certainly playing up on that with the whole Georgiou thing.
Yeah.
So it could, you know, they could.
But a whole ship.
Yeah. we also don't know how well known the Discovery is. You know, at the beginning of the series, they were kind of intimating that it was sort of a black ops sort of test platform.
Yeah.
So it may not be a very widely known ship at all to begin with, which will cause problems for them later on down the road with this series if they keep that ship, which I don't see them destroying the Discovery and then changing the series' name.
Right.
that's kind of something I've been wrestling with about further seasons is, you know, it kind of feels like the Discovery has been a classified thing all along, but you know, how far can you go with a classified ship if you're going to have an ongoing series?
Well, I guess time will tell. We'll see where they pivot to next week.
Yeah.
And they obviously have something in mind. I mean, you can't tell a show these days without having both season-long arcs and series-long arcs kind of spelled out. So,
yeah.
I got to think that there is a season two planned or at least a rudimentary idea for a season three. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So they'll figure it out. Whether or not they do it to our satisfaction, well, that's something else entirely.
Yeah, true. But Cornwall fills in some gaps. So, they didn't have the cloak breaking tech that they had developed before they, you know, went to the mirror universe. So the Klingons were free to destroy planets and star bases and go on suicide missions and detonate themselves in space dock and all that kind of stuff. And Sarek says that there's no clear Klingon leader. So essentially the Federation is fighting 24 houses independently. So none of the attacks are correlated to one another. It's just, hey, this side's attacking, now this side's attacking, now this side's attacking. And it's really, you know, it's really depleting their resources. 20% of Federation space is now occupied. So she says they're going to take the Discovery to Starbase 1 to and delete any record of the Mirror Universe. It says knowledge of it could cause problems in a war-torn universe. So Starbase 1... we've heard of that before, right? That's close to Earth.
Well,
they said
okay.
It was 100 AUs from Earth,
which is
not that close. Well, but not it, relative. Well, in space terms, that's relatively close.
It's like still within the solar system, but yeah. They showed it in orbit.
Yeah.
Was that Earth? Maybe it was a terraformed Neptune.
Okay.
But
I'm going to go with Europa. That was Europa. That
yeah. All right, I'll buy that.
But Stamets tells Cornwall he can't jump without spores. So they have to use the warp drive and go all the way through enemy space to get there, and then Michael,
which proves not to be a problem at all.
Yeah, they don't run into any problems. They're like, oh, they're gonna get attacked. Nope, they don't get attacked. Michael,
I mean, the show could have done with at least one skirmish, right? So it would have been a perfect action drop right there.
Well, to have 20% of the Federation space taken over by Klingons, and we don't see any Klingons in this episode other than Laurel.
Yeah, and the thing is, when they get to Starbase 1, wouldn't it be a little bit, I mean, just dramatically, to be there for, like, the last stand for Starbase 1, watch right. it as the Klingons actually conquer it and realize that you can't do anything about it instead of just seeing a floating derelict. I guess you had Cornwall's moment there where she just basically lost it,
which I love that they let her do that.
And
Saru had to step in and say, get us the hell out of here, you know.
Yeah,
but it would have been nice for them to fly directly into the heart of a skirmish
without
even realizing it, you know.
Yeah, this episode didn't have any like action scenes at all. It was just like we said, it was exposition. I don't know if they spent so much money on last week that they had to take a break because they're planning on doing something big next week.
That's what I was hoping. I hope they're saving it all for the finale.
Yeah. So, okay. So Michael introduces Cornwall to the Emperor, and that's all I wrote down. she meets the Emperor. So she's proven once and for all that everything that they're saying about the mirror universe is true, because obviously she knows Georgiou is dead.
Can I let out one of my dirty little secrets about Discovery?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think that Georgiou is a compelling character at all. I think that Michelle Yeoh plays her adequately, but there's nothing about the character that ever spoke to me, nothing about Yeoh's performance that ever moved me. And the fact that now they have her in sort of the pseudo campy villain role from the Mirror Universe, which everybody seems to adopt when they play a Mirror Universe version of themselves, it's not helping me like that character anymore. So the big twist at the end of this where, oh, Georgiou is alive, it's not doing that much for me. I know, Rick, that you have repeatedly said how much you adore Michelle Yeoh and how much you adore the character that she's playing on this, but I have just found that she wholly failed to resonate with me in the first two episodes, and the fact that she's back does absolutely nothing for me as a fan.
I hate to agree with you on this, but I do. I loved her in the beginning. I loved Georgiou, Captain Georgiou. Emperor Georgiou, yeah, leaves me cold. Right. I don't want this to sound reductive or anything, but it's almost like a kitten trying to be fierce. I mean, I know that Michelle Yeoh could kick my ass up one side and down the other. I know she is a very skilled martial artist. She's a dancer, a very able physical actor, but I don't buy the menace.
That's exactly where I was going to go with that. That's exactly what I was going to say. Does she convey? It's not reductive to say that she doesn't adequately portray a sense of menace on screen. Yeah. She doesn't. There doesn't seem to be any stakes in dealing with her as a menacing figure.
Yeah, I haven't seen her do anything evil enough to other than the fidget spinner scene. You know, I haven't seen her do anything evil enough to warrant the what people say about her. You know, how evil she is. She's doing a lot of mustache twirling kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Michelle Yeoh is having a blast playing the character.
Oh yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, you know what it reminds me of? Have either of y'all seen Dredd, the Carl Urban Judge Dredd movie?
Negative. I haven't, no.
Ah, okay. Lena Headey played the top villain in that one, and while she did a great job, as Lena Headey always does, I spent most of the time wondering, how is this person in this position of power over all of these incredibly much more badass people than she is, kind of thing. And it's kind of this, you know, I just don't accept the Emperor Georgiou as being someone who could have become Emperor of the Terran Empire. I believed Hoshi a whole lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also Hoshi had the firepower to back it up, and
exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And I think you knew that character better too, so it was fun to see that twist.
Yeah. Which is the problem with the Mirror Universe in general. You know, going there in your first season, I think, is kind of not the best idea. And from what I've heard, I think I mentioned this last week. Who was the first EP? Brian Fuller.
He wanted to go there sooner.
Much sooner, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, As a matter of fact, I was listening to you say that in the supermarket while I was shopping yesterday, Rick. So you did say it later.
Yeah, I think he wanted to go there like in the fourth or fifth episode, you know, really soon in the season. And probably spend more of the season there than they did. I think that would have been a mistake. Because I think the way that they did it, letting us get to know the characters a little bit better, made it that much more compelling when we started to see mirror versions of these characters and things like that. So, yeah. After they get to Starbase 1 and it's been taken over by House T'Gor, 80,000 lives are gone. Cornwall freezes and Cyril orders him to warp. Well, then Cornwall goes to visit Laurel and asks her basically, what's it going to take to end this war? And Laurel tells her the war is not going to end. You know, the Klingons have tasted your blood, and unless you conquer us, you know, we're gonna keep on beating you. Basically,
I love that line: "Conquer us, or we will never relent."
Yeah,
yeah. I thought that was probably the tied for the best scene of the episode. Since there was so much exposition, you got to choose which exposition you found really compelling. And I thought that was equal to one other scene as the highlight of the show.
I don't disagree.
Yeah, I'm kind of teeter-tottering because the storyline with the war and everything is compelling, but at the same time, we know how the war ends. We know that the Federation wins and that eventually there's peace between the Federation and the Klingons. So when she said that, I was like, well, yeah, but that's what they're going to do. They're going to beat you.
Well,
Sean, I don't know that you can say that we know the Federation wins. We know that there's detente. We know that there's the establishment of a neutral zone.
Yeah.
That's not a victory.
Yeah. The war ends. We don't know if anyone wins because what the actual final end of hostilities was imposed on both factions by the Organians.
Okay, I did not know that.
In the original series, yeah, but they were very loosey-goosey about that after the fact. It was a good one-off kind of idea, but they rarely ever brought it up again in the original series. Maybe two more times just to pay lip service to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was even one of the novels mentioned the Organian Peace Treaty, and Kirk said something to the effect, well, if they're still around, nobody's heard from them, so... You know, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay,
so hold on a second. I was writing the John while you were talking.
No, it's all right. Do you want me to take it from?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The other scene that I thought was equal to that one between Laurel and Cornwall was the one between Sarek and Georgiou about Michael.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed that one, and I thought Sarek came off as just badass in that.
Oh yeah,
you know, like Vulcan badass, but badass nonetheless. You know, he schooled her. I loved it.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
At the beginning of that conversation,
they were getting into a "My Michael is better than your Michael."
Yeah,
yeah.
Argument.
My wife, My wife turned to me and went, mine's bigger than yours.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was a real standout for me. And maybe it's because I found, oh, it's a scene with Giorgio and I'm actually engaged. Maybe that just had something to do with it. I don't know. But
Because I mean, it's frustrating because I do love Michelle Yeoh's work. And, you know, she is a more than competent actor. Little moments like that, she's just brilliant. I think some of the one-on-one conversations with her and Burnham with Sinequa Martin-Green are good too. It's just like you said, the whole absence of really being afraid of her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, okay, so they come up with a plan that they want to attack all the defenses on the Klingon homeworld at once. They actually plan to use the spore drive to jump inside the planet and map the surface from the inside out. But first, a side quest, because they have to go to the Veda system, where they're going to terraform a desolate moon because they can do that. I don't know. Because last week they were like, oh, we're almost out of spores. I don't know if we're going to have enough spores to do this. I was like, well, if you could terraform a moon in 15 minutes, then why didn't you do that?
Yeah, that was what?
Yeah.
And doesn't it take generations to terraform a world?
Unless you have the Genesis weapon.
Exactly. And, that's 30, 40 years away. Right. So.
Well, they didn't so much terraform it as just super spore it.
Well, he was calling it terraforming.
I know they did say terraforming, but well, okay. We have not said this all along. And I've kind of come to terms with it because otherwise the whole show is going to piss me off. But this whole mushroom spore mycelial network thing has never really worked for me anyway. It's a little too close to space magic for my liking in Star Trek. So the fact that they could go, oh, well, we're all out of spores until we're not.
Yeah.
I mean, we've certainly seen worse contrivances in Star Trek, so I'm kind of willing to give it a pass.
Yeah.
I did love the sequence of the launching the things and then going down to the planet and the shooting into the soil and the EM bursts, and I have no idea what any of it was doing, but it looked really cool.
It was pretty baller, wasn't it?
Yeah. I put in my notes, I put planet terraform accomplish unlocked. So they did what they wanted to do. They terraformed the planet. They got basically an endless supply of spores now.
Now, can you guys reconcile that cavalier attitude with, quote, terraforming that planet at the, you know, at the drop of a hat with Carol Marcus saying there can't be so much as a microbe on the planet's surface, otherwise the deal is off? And is that a kinder, gentler Starfleet?
Yeah.
Post-war in the future?
I think that what they're trying to say is, you know, we're seeing desperate measures. They are, you know, this close to being snuffed out. And so, while I don't think the crew is going to be as willing to go as far as obviously Cornwell is, I think we're going to see it. You know,
But, you know, that being the case, I wish they just would have gone a little bit more DS9. On that, and oh, there's a colony on that planet. Maybe it's 30 people. Then we get into the whole insurrection thing. But I just think it could have been more compelling. It could have been more of that sort of that Star Trek ideal dilemma that you could face. And again, this goes to something I want to discuss a little later in the show, but just another missed opportunity to have some actual Star Trek style drama.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, what I was trying to formulate the words for is this feels like, even though this is a 15 episode season, this feels like we're getting into that tried and true Star Trek trope of if we compare this 15 episode season to a 42 minute long episode, we've spent 14 episodes or, you know, 40 minutes setting up the problem. And now we're going to use the last episode or the last 2 minutes to solve it.
Right. Yeah. 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 They pretty much did. I mean, there was never any real drama there. I mean, they went and they put the spores on the planet. They grew spores, you know, it's done.
Now, right, I do get the impression that Stamets has had this plan in mind for a long time because he knew exactly where he wanted to go and he knew exactly how to do it.
He even said that it was the other guy, I guess it was the head scientist who got twisted in episode 3 or 4 or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Said he put the quash on it. He didn't want them to go wild. Like, why wouldn't you want to have a whole planet full of the one resource you need to make your grand experiment work? That's because show, Sean. That is, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, you've got this magic engine that takes a certain kind of fuel, and you know, we can have all these episodes where the main plot point is, we don't have enough fuel. It's kind of like, you know, the fact that they have in The Next Generation and Voyager and all those. How many times could the entire plot be finished just by using the transporter? Well, they have to make sure the transporter doesn't work.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, that's like in Voyager, there was an episode where they were out of deuterium and they had to find deuterium where they were, you know, they were dead in the water. And I've got a book right next to me called the Star Trek The Next Generation Technical Manual, which was written by Rick Sternbach and Michael Okuda. So it's more or less considered canon, although it gets way, way more intense than they would ever do on a show.
Yeah.
The reason they chose deuterium as the matter fuel for starships is because it's an isotope of the single most abundant element in the fucking universe.
Right.
It's an isotope of hydrogen.
You know, there is no hydrogen in the Delta Quadrant. You know that?
What'd you guys think of the scene between Michael and Sarek?
The hallway scene.
In the hallway, yeah.
I really liked it. Again, because Sarek came alive as a character for me. I mean, we've come to expect that Michael is going to be cagey and, I guess, wary of any kind of contact. And it was nice to see her let her guard down with Tyler, but you knew that this was going to, you know, put those Vulcan walls right back up. More Vulcan than Vulcan. And you got to see Sarek, and this is the way they portrayed Sarek sometimes in some of the novels, and just sort of that Vulcan serenity. It's not so much a shunning of emotion. It's controlling your emotions. And for him to say to her, you know, you're human, your mother is human, don't ever be sorry that you love somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is more quintessentially Vulcan. That's why Kirk can say, of all the souls I've encountered in the universe, his was the most human. Because it's not so much that they eschew emotions. They just got, you know, they got it hacked. They got it handled.
Yeah.
So it's a really healthy perspective that Sarek tries to give her. And it shows you how much she fundamentally misunderstands what it is to be Vulcan, because she's not.
Yeah. And then when he puts his hand on her shoulder, I was like, well, that's a very un-Vulcan thing to do. They don't normally.
Well, I thought that too, but it's his daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we, you know, we have it. Sarek is, you know, he, like you said, more Vulcan than Vulcan. I know you were referring to Bill about that, but you know, every time we've seen Sarek in an official capacity, he, you know, he has always been the dispassionate Vulcan. But he even says in Star Trek 3, his logic is uncertain where his children are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it was his son.
Yeah, but you know, we can they're extrapolating that, right? From that.
It's funny you said that line just as it was going through my head too.
You know, they're obviously riffing on that, and there's nothing, you know, this is an established character trait of Sarek. I did think it was the Vulcan equivalent of an emotional outburst, though. And I think that maybe the events we're about to see unfold may push him back inside his shell a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, what I loved about it was, number one, they didn't go in for the hug, which you knew, any other show would have done that. And it's a testament to, at least some of the writers really get it, because they wouldn't have hugged. But the fact that Sarek was the one to initiate sort of that special goodbye was as close as you're going to get to him saying, "I'm scared."
Yeah.
And I thought it came through beautifully within the, perfectly keeping within the character.
Yeah. What's the guy's name? No, it's not Rain.
James Frayne.
Frayne. He is just nailing Sarek.
Yeah.
I was skeptical when they said Sarek was going to be a character. I'm always a little worried when someone else is playing an established character. But they've proven me wrong with the Harry Mudd and with Sarek. I'm sorry.
I don't think they proved you wrong with Harry Mudd, but go ahead.
You didn't like Rain as Mudd?
That's the show I wanted to be on the most. I fucking hated Rain Wilson as Mudd. Anyway.
I'm curious why.
Number one, they turned him into a remorseless murderer. I'm not a huge Rain Wilson fan. I don't dislike him, but I don't especially like him. And there's that certain swagger and that the original series Mudd had that made him much more appealing. This was just a snake, the way he was written and the way Rain Wilson played him. And I don't think that fundamental humor to the character was there. Like, Mudd on the original series was a rogue and a charming rogue. This Mudd had no charm at all. And given to, murderous histrionics, is that the word I'm looking for? Hysteria? I don't know. But I also had a huge, huge, huge problem with the time loop episode. Partly because those stories have their own inherent flaw. That kind of story, I find it hard to believe. And mainly because of what they did to Mudd in that episode, just turning him into just a remorseless murderer. And also a huge missed opportunity. That episode should have been told from the point of view of Stamets. You know why? Because he was the only one living outside of that loop. And it was ridiculous to have Michael, because no matter how many times the loop starts, Michael has to start from square one. Mm-hmm. But the story and the audience expectation demand that she become as emotionally invested as you are by the third act. So they conveniently forget that it's fresh for her every time. And she should only be able to get so far before the loop resets. No, it's just the loop resets and she is just determined to get, So it's a flaw in both the structure of that kind of story and in the writing of that episode. Imagine if you had seen Stamets disconnected from time and the way he perceived that entire thing. That would have been mind-blowing. And I think that they should have really focused on that. But, you got to have Sonequa in the front, I guess. And that's fine. She's the star of the show. But missed opportunity, in my opinion. And just hated what they did with the Mudd character.
That's inherent with any time loop story, because there's only so many times that you can go through the time loop without having one of the characters at least either figure out what's going on or whatever, and just basically you have to write them as though they're not being affected anymore. or else you'll never get to the end of the episode.
And that's it. And that's usually why these time loop stories are told from the point of view of somebody actually living through it and realizing what's happening.
Because
it's the only way to propel the story forward. You know what I mean? So,
well, Michael tells Ash that he should have come to her as soon as he started to break, and he says he doesn't know who he is anymore, and she's letting her prejudice against the Klingons cloud her judgment. And she says that she can't put behind her the fact that he tried to kill her. So pretty much tells him that, it's over. And they're not going to be
together. Well, hang on. Let's not gloss over this scene. This was a big scene.
Yeah, it was a big scene.
I never related more to Ash than in this scene, because especially the second time I watched it, because she finally goes to him and it's the only thing he wanted, and then he takes one step towards her and she takes two steps back and he realizes this isn't going to go well. and she starts in on him, you know, with the "you lied to me," and he just lashes back with an almost a non sequitur argument. And it reminded me of more than one breakup I've had where I was being broken up with, where I was like, all right, I've got justification for being mad. I'm going to say something angry, and then immediately realize it was the exactly worst wrong thing to say.
Even though Sonique it was so factually true and on the nose.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, and she just reacted like she'd been slapped. And you could see that the act, you know, Martin Green's acting in this is beautiful because you could see, you know, you could see that look on her face of, I'm going to turn around and walk out, but no, you're not getting off that easy. And just the progression of that whole argument slash discussion slash end of their relationship, at least as far as, you know, right now, was so real. You know, I've been in that argument. Granted, I've never been a, you know, Klingon agent, nor have I ever tried to kill a girlfriend. But, you know, there was nothing that felt, you know, even though like that opening salvo on its surface seemed totally bizarre that Ash would lash out like that because he wants her back. You know, if you've been there, you know how that feels. And it was so honest. In a situation that is very often contrived on TV.
Yeah.
You know, if it had ended with them crying in each other's arms, I would have been like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, or you know, with what I liked about it is that Ash wasn't he wasn't begging her to take him back. I mean, he sort of was, but it wasn't just him being a doormat.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what made that scene so dynamic, because otherwise it really would have been her being self-righteously justified in hating him and him being, please forgive me. And that would have stunk on ice. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad that they sort of did that twist. And it's another one of the scenes that stood out, and especially for acting with both of them. There's something inherently likable about what's I forget his name. I want to say Javad Iqbal, but it's not Javad. His alter ego, but he's just something about him on screen makes him likable. And it's whenever he's in the Tyler character, I just immediately cotton to him. So I liked the fact that he stood his ground, even though she's right. I mean, the last time I saw you, you had your hands on my throat and you were going to murder me. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, yeah, well, you know, sorry. you're not blameless here either. Even though she is, but I found it a much better way to go, Rick. I think you're 100% right on that.
If I had to guess, I think that this will be one of the main storylines that's going to continue on into the season two, unless they surprise me next episode and kill Ash, which I don't think they will. I think that he's going to be a character in season two. I don't think that this storyline is going to be resolved next episode. I think it's going to be one of the things that continues on.
But, yeah.
Well, I think one of the strongest things about that scene was when Burnham walked away, I didn't sense that the door had closed at all. I sensed the fact that she had something to think about, and she was actually more compelled than she would have been had it been written in a different way.
Yeah.
I don't think they ended the relationship in any way in that. I think that they just brought it to a different place.
Yeah, yeah. I think she just basically, she was telling him it's over. But, you know, we've all been in relationships where we say things, we say it's over, uh-huh. but it's not over, you know.
And the whole scene was just like, you tried to kill me. And he's just like laying down the Vok Fu, and she walks away like, I can't even.
The Vok Fu.
To be continued.
Right. Well, Cornwall decides that their best bet to beat the Klingons is to do it the Emperor's way. So she dresses up the Emperor as Georgiou and passes her off as a POW that they rescued. And Georgiou takes command of the Discovery as credits roll. I did not expect that. I did not expect for them to take the Emperor and try and pass her off as Georgiou, because who knows what she's going to do. They're putting her in command of the ship, which I know Cornwall considers herself to be pulling the strings. I don't think the Emperor believes anybody's pulling her strings.
Yeah, I was wondering about that myself. But Rick, you go first, I guess.
I think it's clear that both Cornwell and Sarek, although I'm a little, I mean, we've seen that Sarek has a kill them all, let God sort them out attitude when it comes to the Klingons anyway. It feels to me like what they're saying is, all right, we put her in the captain's chair. When the genocide is over, our hands are clean.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
I don't know about that, because they're the one that put her there. I was just thinking of it from a logical story writing point of view, is you're going to need her in the captain's seat because she's the one who can anticipate what they might find on Kronos. And there is no other way, since they're burying the knowledge of the mirror universe, than to have this elaborate fabrication. So she's got to be Captain Georgiou. There's just no way around it if they're going to have her out on point on this mission. I didn't ever even consider the whole let the blame lie at her feet aspect of it until now, and that's kind of compelling. Not very Starfleet.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I was saying desperate measures. We're seeing – there's been some discussion online about whether or not Cornwell is a quote-unquote badmiral.
Aren't they all badmirals in Star Trek? Yeah.
I don't think she is. I think she is a very competent leader who has been pushed beyond her breaking point. And apparently Sarek thinks so as well, because he has convinced her that whatever they've got in mind, which we see in the coming attractions, has really pissed off Burnham, is the necessary step. Now, why they think they can obliterate the Klingons from inside of Kronos, who knows?
No, that's not what they said they were going to do. They're going inside Kronos to map the surface.
That's what the Emperor told Burnham.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, if you can spore drive into the heart of a planet, you can just pull a freaking Nero on them and, you know, implode the core.
Yeah.
And spore drive out. So why bother with the whole rigmarole of we're going to be doing cave jumping, subterranean cave jumping?
Yeah. And we know that's not going to happen because Kronos is still there later shows. So unless they're going to pull a JJ and make this another alternate timeline or something like that.
The writers were again point blank asked on Twitter last week, is this in the Prime universe that we know with Kirk and Spock and everything that we're used to? And they said yes.
Yeah, okay. And to me, that's exciting. It opens up storytelling possibilities, because you know that they can't destroy the Klingon homeworld. So what does happen here? And I'm curious to see. I mean, just because I know what isn't going to happen doesn't mean I know what is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm excited to see where they take it, because on the surface, it's a very interesting premise to me. If you don't get too far into the weeds of fandom, it's like a starship jumping through subterranean caverns. Can Stamets even pull that off? You know, and it's almost like Riker with the Pegasus. It's very intriguing.
Yeah.
On is this tech gonna work? And I'm excited anyway to see where they bring that. I hope they bring that to a satisfying conclusion, or at least a compelling sort of set piece for that whole idea. I would be very disappointed if they kind of nipped it in the bud before they were even able to get to Kronos, because I want to see that.
Well, we saw in the coming attractions the discovery in a cavern. So.
Oh, okay. I turned it off because I didn't want to see any spoiler coming attractions, Rick.
But, oh, sorry.
I know. Like, no, it's okay. You said it last week. You're on a podcast talking about this stuff. You don't have the luxury of avoiding spoilers.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, what would be hilarious is, you know, 1,000 years from now, a Klingon archaeological expedition breaks through this cavern and finds this derelict ship, and they get inside and they find the crew had eaten each other.
And somewhere, you know, just a little ways away is Data's head.
Right. That's one thing that occurred to me as I was watching the end of the episode. All of the Klingons that we've met before are all gone. All the Klingons that we met in the first couple of episodes, they're all dead. Like Kor and his ship all exploded. So any of the Klingons that actually physically saw Georgiou should be gone. Because what I was thinking was when she shows up to Kronos, there's going to be somebody there that was like eating her. And they're going to know that that's not really her. But then it occurred to me, well, no, all those Klingons are all dead. So,
well, even if they're not, you know, just because if, you know, if maybe they got a finger or two, doesn't mean they'd recognize the corpse they were chewing on.
Yeah.
And if they do, that's like worthy of a Klingon opera. She'd be epic.
What do you guys have? Anything else you want to add before we?
Yeah, it's pronounced Kalis, not Kalark. I can't stand that. Does that take you out of the story every time?
Yeah,
is that just me?
The Klingon pronunciation has kind of morphed over time, but I like the accuracy with which they're pronouncing everything. I don't know if y'all ever had it. I had I didn't buy it. It was given to me by a friend, a girlfriend. The Klingon dictionary that Marco
put out. I have the first edition. It came out as part of the Star Trek paperback novel. So yeah, and a girlfriend didn't give it to me. I bought it myself.
I had it, but I never.
Hence why I didn't have a girlfriend to give it to me.
I had it, but I was never smart enough to actually learn the languages.
And well, also, I was just buying the books at that point. I don't know if I've ever opened it, to be honest with you. It's still on my shelf.
Well, and then students of mine gave me the book tape of it, and it's called Conversational Klingon, and it's not exactly the audio book of the Klingon dictionary. It's just kind of an audio book based on it, and it's narrated by Michael Dorn, and it is some really classic fan service cheese. If you can ever get your hands on it, it's embarrassing, but it does go heavily into proper Klingon pronunciation, and they are really nailing it on this show, but it doesn't sound conversational at all. And it does kind of pull me out a little bit when they say Kalish. Let me ask you, especially Chris, Sean, I'm not. I don't know if this would even register to you, and that's not in any way a dig.
It might even be a compliment. We'll see what he asks.
Did the fake handheld camera stuff when Georgiou and Burnham were talking bother you?
I didn't even notice it, but I was a big fan of NYPD Blue back in the day when they pioneered that. So
okay,
it doesn't bug the crap out of me. That shaky cam stuff, I barely even register it now. I notice steady cam more than I notice shaky cam.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, they try to incorporate some elements from the Abrams movies into this show because, believe it or not, there are people out there that are Star Trek fans that have never seen anything other than this show and those three movies.
Heresy!
I know. There are.
I'm jealous. Look at all they have to look forward to.
Most of them are very young, you know, in their 20s or whatever. But they didn't want those people to come in to watch this show and not have anything that they didn't recognize, you know, not have anything that they recognized. So so they added some lens flare in the first couple of episodes, and that's let up. They haven't done that a lot since then. But those first couple of episodes, there was a lot of lens flare and then stuff like that, like what you were just talking about, shaky cam kind of stuff, because they did that a lot in those movies. So that's their way of doing a little bit of fan service just to the fans that only know Star Trek from those films.
I don't mind the idea of it. It was so, no cameraman worth his salt would have been that shaky. Even if
I'll have to watch it again and see if it angers me now.
hope I don't ruin it.
Oh, no, they shake. Yeah, they shake when they do stuff like that, like what Chris was talking about, NYPD Blue. They shook it more on purpose.
they said shake it more.
Yeah, they thought they had to make it look more realistic by shaking the camera around. So,
but I mean that was, I mean, I guess you could go into the influence of Cops on that, with that was such a smash hit for Fox, and most of it was cameramen running after cops, running after perps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I think that they wanted to get that immediacy in NYPD Blue, which is why some of the scenes give you a whiplash, especially the establishing shots.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been done so much now, it's almost de rigueur. I don't really notice it that much anymore. It's just it's now just part and parcel. It's sort of woven into the way we consume TV at this point.
Kind of like bullet time. You know, when they did bullet time in The Matrix, it was revolutionary. Now it's right. Standard. You know.
Yeah. Now it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Can I ask you guys one thing? And this is I was alluding to this before, but Sean, do we have 5 more minutes just to geek out a tiny bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was watching Our Man Bashir, DS9 episode, which is basically a hologram episode, a holodeck episode.
The James Bond thing.
The James Bond one. It was Bashir and Garrick with Bashir's alter ego on the holodeck, and they you know, some way they contrived that all of the main characters were stuck in a transporter beam and they got beamed onto the holodeck because it was the only matrix that could hold their personalities before they could rematerialize. All right. So they were playing these characters, and it was just like a really cool, goofy episode. And I thought to myself, you know, we're so used to now TV seasons being 10 or 12 or 13 episodes long that you just don't have the time to do episodes like that. And are we missing something these days in this current TV environment? Because I know a lot of the episodes are padding in that whole 22, 24, sometimes 26 episode seasons. But at the same time, I think without those kinds of long seasons, you never would have gotten something like City on the Edge of Forever. You never would have gotten Trouble with Tribbles or Trials and Tribulations. And yeah. I was thinking about that because I was trying to – this is what a geek I am. I was watching Trials and Tribulations, and I said, wouldn't it be great if I could mash this together with the original series Trouble with Tribbles? So I was literally on Netflix going back and forth between each series as the scenes were changing to try to juxtapose it. And I said, somebody had to have done this online and just made a mashup. I couldn't find it, though. So I'm putting the call out to anyone out there. But when I was talking about the dilemma that they might have faced on the Spore planet before, just terraforming that and just the ethical ramifications of that. That would have been a full episode mm-hmm. of Next Gen, or maybe even the original series. I'm not sure about the original series, but the fact that they had to gloss over it because story. We got to wrap this up. We got to go. Are we missing something that's inherent to Star Trek? Are we missing something that makes Trek, Trek? I mean, arguably, without a 26-episode season, you wouldn't have had something like Far Beyond the Stars,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which everybody, you know, points as like the pinnacle of DS9.
Yeah.
So I'd be curious to know what you guys think of this.
Well, we've just got it's a standard of modern television for everything to be shorter now. I don't know if it's because they want to take the same budget that they would normally spend on 26 episodes and just make 13 really good episodes instead of, you know, having a few filler episodes. Because if you think about it, if you make 10 filler episodes a season, 3 of them are going to be good filler episodes. And the rest of them are just going to be, you know, there. That's when you get episodes that have, like, their musical episodes and things like that.
And you're not wrong with that. I just feel like... But, you know, you're so constrained now, there's just no way to take like a flight of fancy. There's no way to pose a what-if scenario that could bring you something incredible.
Well, I think we saw, I think you're right. I agree that there is, there is something lost in having these very short seasons. But also that's kind of the way the world has evolved, or the viewing public has evolved. You know, in my life, I've seen movies go from 2.5 hour long kind of explorations of stuff to, you know, back in the 80s, maybe the early 90s, you were getting down to less than 90 minutes for a feature film.
And yeah, 86 minutes.
Yeah. And then the time started creeping up again, and then you hit like Chariots of Fire, which is almost 3 freaking hours long. You know, the attention span of the public kind of fluctuates. I think maybe, hopefully, we're hitting sort of the low end with these 10 to 12 to 15 episode seasons. And then, you know, maybe things will start lengthening again. I don't know. It's hard to say with the, you know, the Netflix mentality now of, you know, I want it all and I want it right now. You know, the fact that this is coming out weekly is ruffling feathers. You know, look at how many people complained about Magics to Make the Mind Go Numb or whatever the hell it was.
And apparently I'm one of them. I'm right there on the forefront.
Not necessarily from a you know, whether you liked the story or not. It was, you're like, that didn't do anything to further the storyline. Why was it there? You know, that I was hearing a lot of that. I kind of enjoyed it for the fact that it was like, oh, we could take a breather and just sort of enjoy this, as silly as this series is going to get, episode. And we got a similar thing with the one on Pavo. What, I forget the title. All these titles are really bizarre. Where it was the first time they went to another planet, and it was kind of sort of a self-contained episode.
Very next Jenny. Very next Jenny episode.
Yes, very much so. And again, some people were like not pleased with this diversion from the main drive of the story. And I, you know, that one kind of confuses me, because if you look at the opening animation, the credits, the Pav and crystals are all over the place, floating around the ship and stuff.
I don't know if I buy your idea that everything we see in the credits is going to somehow be relevant in the series. I think that that's just a neat sort of production art sketchbook that we're seeing. It's almost like the extras that you get at the hardbound volumes of comic books that you buy.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's
the way I look
so
at
many
it.
Of them. Yeah. You know, even then they're inconsistent, because there's that great shot of the TOS phaser kind of explodes and then comes back as the Discovery phaser, but then we see a TOS communicator and it explodes and doesn't do anything.
Yeah. And how come nobody uses Phaser 1 in this show? I want to see Phaser 1 on the series finale.
That would be cool. I love the Phaser 1s.
It's also kind of a thing for cable television that I think that they kind of started this trend of doing the shorter seasons because they want to be able to put more shows out. So if you've got a prime slot of Monday nights at 10, 9 central, you put some of your best shows, like you've got Better Call Saul, you put that on there for 10 episodes. Well, then when it's over, you can put something else in that same spot and you can just keep doing that throughout the year. You know, you can show 5 seasons of various shows in that one time slot throughout the year. And so I think that's the thinking. That Discovery is a different animal because the entire thing is online. So you've got the same thing as what you've got with Netflix. Netflix does these shorter seasons because they know that people are going to watch this all in one sitting. Star Trek, we're watching it week by week. So it doesn't really work the same way, but they're still kind of treating it the same way.
Well, you know what just occurred to me? And I have absolutely no idea whether this is relevant or not anymore. You know, it used to be that 100 episodes was the magic number to syndicate a show. You know, you needed 100 episodes to be able to
make it pay to have a package that you could sell into syndication. Yep. And I don't think that's true anymore because you see things they're in their second season and they're already showing up on second market. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, because they know that it's all going to be online anyway. You know, if I've got 2 seasons of Scandal, you know, and it's been this huge show or Grey's Anatomy or something like that that has been this huge show that people watch, do I really want to wait until it's 4 or 5 seasons in to start making more money off of it when it's all going to be on Netflix anyway? You know, So yeah, we'll go ahead and start making money. We'll start putting it on every night at 10:30. So
yeah, but I mean, Rick, you're absolutely right, because that used to be like the fifth season, 100th episode. That used to be the magic number, and it's just like, oh, we can finally sell the syndication rights. We're all going to be billionaires.
Yeah.
You know, I think that model has shifted. But I mean, I guess maybe that's what we're talking about, just like sort of the shifting models of the way we watch TV. And I think, like you were talking about Better Call Saul, Sean,
yeah,
or even like Breaking Bad, or even think of like The Walking Dead. It's such a simple premise that all of those shows are basically character studies. Mm-hmm. Even though they have through lines and plot lines, they're really all about the characters interacting with the situations that they're in on a very personal level. This is Star Trek Discovery is a much more action oriented show and a much more plot driven show. And I just feel like we're missing some of that deeper character work that we got out of most of Star Trek up until this point, whether it was very good or very bad. I mean, they did it very badly in a lot of shows too. And I mean, to the franchise's detriment. That's kind of what killed Star Trek on TV to begin with. But I just feel like we could find that middle ground again. And maybe I just miss DS9 too much. I don't know.
I would like to see a much lighter show in the second season, because as much as I'm enjoying Discovery, it is exhausting. You know, when I think about, you know, what you're saying, I'm actually kind of looking forward to the season finale to sort of take a breather, which I've never felt before in Star Trek. And it's not that I think the series is bad. It's just, it's been so intense.
Yeah, it's relentless, right?
Yeah. And, you know, maybe in season two, when we're out of the war, it would be nice if maybe they did lighten up a bit and let us have a fun episode from time to time, or, you know, maybe get a little more episodic, which I don't know if they're going to be able to do that. But it might be nice to see a few self-contained, hey, let's go find a planet where people are nice to us for a change kind of episode.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think that's pretty much going to do it for this week. If you want to hear us talk about stuff besides Star Trek, then come over to our other podcast over at CosmicPotato.com, and you can hear us go on and on about some other topics. And as far as this show goes, of course, it's available on SimplySyndicated.com and all the other usual places, iTunes and Stitcher and all that. They've got tons of other podcasts over there, and you can sign up to be a Simply Everything subscriber and get access to their entire back catalog, which is hundreds of hours of podcasts for about $8 a month or £6 a month, depending on where you live. And you can get in touch with us by joining our Facebook group, which is Simply Syndicated's Discovery After Show. Or you can leave us a voicemail or a text message by dialing area code 205-642-8380. And at least one person has done that in the past.
But, he's not going to let me make that joke again ever.
Now, next week, we're gonna have our contest. This week, I'm going to go through our Facebook, our group, and all of our voicemails and our iTunes reviews and emails. And I'm going to gather the names of everyone who has participated in the show, and we're going to give away a prize. It was going to be a novel, but I think the prize is going to be a Discovery era Starfleet insignia pin. So if you want a chance to win that prize, then go over to our Facebook page this week and leave us a message, or go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. And if you have been a guest host on this season of the show, you are disqualified. Sorry, Chris.
I kind of knew I would be, and I wouldn't take it. There are much more deserving fans out there. I get to shoot my mouth off. That's reward enough.
I was hoping it was going to be a TMP VHS.
I have one of those.
I probably do too. I think I've got all six movies. Yeah, I do, right here on my bookshelf, all six movies on VHS. Okay. Well, Chris, thanks for being here this week.
I really appreciate it, Sean. I'll come back anytime you'll have me.
Do you have anything you want to plug?
You can go to my website, deflipside.com. There you'll find a radio show that I do here on Long Island. My last two episodes were my best reads of 2017, and I just did a small tribute to the memory of Ursula K. Le Guin, one of my favorite authors of all time, who recently passed. So you can go there, deflipside.com. You'll also find links to my other podcasts and to a whole plethora of geeky nonsense.
Alrighty. Rick, thanks for being here.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Chris. It's always great to talk to you, sir.
You guys too. Anytime you need someone to just shoot their mouth off for hours on end, you know where to look.
I had one other thing I wanted to plug before we closed out, and let me pull it up here on my Facebook page because I don't want to get it wrong. Okay, friend of the show, Michael Jan Friedman, who is a Star Trek novelist, and he's written comic books for Marvel and DC, done some Star Wars titles. He wrote an episode of Star Trek Voyager and things like that. He is doing a Kickstarter campaign right now for a comic book that he's trying to start. And it's called Empty Space, and he describes it as being Star Trek mixed with Lost. So basically, there is a character that's on a starship, kind of like Star Trek, but he wakes up and he doesn't have any memory of how he got there, and he's the captain, you know. So,
I've had that dream.
Yeah. So if you go to our Facebook group page, I put a link there last week to the Kickstarter campaign, and it would be great if some of our fans, some of our listeners, would go and support him on that, so that he can get that comic started. But other than that, that's it for this episode. We'll be back next week to talk about the season finale, which is titled "Will You Take My Hand?" And we'll see you then.
Thank you for joining us for Simply Syndicated's Discovery After Show. Your feedback is welcome. Leave us a comment and review on iTunes, or follow us on Facebook. The views and opinions stated on this program are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of Simply Syndicated, CBS, Paramount Pictures, or their sponsors. Star Trek Discovery is owned by CBS and has no affiliation with Simply Syndicated or this podcast. No infringement of copyrighted material is intended. Be sure to join us again next week as we analyze another episode of Star Trek Discovery here on Simply Syndicated's Discovery After Show.